Side 7. Down Below Station by C.J. Cherry. Continuing on page 218. Bluetooth dreamed of that, perhaps, as the heat of her spring faded, and she had not quickened, being young, in her first adult season. Bluetooth saw things now with a clearer head. He mourned the world at times. At times she did. But to be there always and forever. Sky sees her. That was her name. And she had seen truth. The blue was false, a cover stretched out like a great blanket. Truth was black distances and the face of great sun shining in the dark. Truth would always hang above them. Without the favor of humans, they would return to down below without hope, forever and ever to know themselves shut off from the sky. There was no home now, not now that they had looked upon sun. Lucas's go away sometime, Bluetooth murmured against her ear. She burrowed her head against him, trying to forget that she was hungry and thirsty, and did not answer him. Guns, said another voice near them. They will shoot us, and we will lose ourselves forever. Not if we stay here, said Bluetooth, and do what I said. They are not our humans, said Big Fellow's deep voice. Hurt our humans, these. This is a man fight, Bluetooth returned. Nothing for the Hysa. A thought came. Satin lifted her head. Constantine's. Constantine fight this. We will find Constantine's. Ask what to do. Find Constantine's. Find old ones, too, near Sun's place. Ask Sun her friend, another exclaimed. She must know. Where is Sun her friend? There was silence. No one knew. The old ones preserved that secret. I will find her. That was Big Fellow. He wriggled close to them, reached out a hand to her shoulder in the dark. I go many places. Come, come. She drew in her breath, lipped uncertainly at Bluetooth's cheek. Come, Bluetooth agreed suddenly, drawing her by the hand. Big Fellow hastened off just ahead, a pattering of feet in the dark. They went after him and others followed, up the dark corridors and the ladders and the narrow places, where sometimes there was light and most times not. Some fell behind, for they went among pipes and in cold places, and places which burned their bare feet, and past machinery which thundered with ominous powers. Bluetooth pushed into the lead at times, letting go her hand. At times Big Fellow shoved him aside and went first again. Satin doubted, in fact, that Bluetooth had the least idea where he was going, or what way would lead them to Sun her friend, to the Sun's place they had been, and dimly she had that sense she had on the earth, that said in her heart what way a place should be. Up was true, she thought, that it should be left, but sometimes the tunnels did not bend left, and they wound. The two males pushed ahead, one and then the other, until they were all panting and stumbling, more and more fell behind, and at last the one behind her caught her hand, pleaded by that gesture. But Bluetooth and Big Fellow pushed on, and she was losing them. She parted from the last of their followers and kept going, trying to overtake them. No more, she pleaded when she had caught them on the metal steps. No more, let us go back, you are lost. Big Fellow would not heed. Panting, he edged higher. She tugged at Bluetooth and he hissed in frustration, and went after Big Fellow. Madness, madness had settled on them. You show me nothing, she wailed. She bounced in despair and hastened after, panting, trying to reason with them, who had passed beyond reasoning. They passed panels and doors where they might have gotten out into the open. All these they rejected. But at last they came to a place where they were faced with choices, where a light burned blue above a door, where the ladders extended everywhere, up and down and in three other directions. Here, Big Fellow said after a little hesitation, feeling of the buttons at the lighted door. Here is a way. No, Satin moaned, no. Bluetooth objected too, perhaps recovering his senses, but Big Fellow pushed the first button and slipped into the air chamber when the door opened. Come back, Bluetooth exclaimed, and they scrambled to stop him, who was mad with the rivalry, who did this for her and for nothing else. They went in after him, the door closed at their backs. The second door opened under Big Fellow's hand as they caught up with him, and there was light, it blinded. And suddenly guns fired, and Big Fellow went down in the doorway with a smell of burning. He cried and shrieked horribly, and Bluetooth whirled and hit the other door button, his hard arm carrying her with him as the door opened and wind surged about them. Man voices bellowed over a sudden wail of alarms, silenced as the door closed. They hit the ladders and ran blindly down and through the dark ways, deep, deep into the dark. They dragged their breathers down, but the air smelt wrong. They finally stopped their running, sweating and shivering. Bluetooth rocked and moaned with pain in the dark, and Satin searched him for a wound, found his fingers locked on his upper arm. She licked the sore place, which was hot and burned, soothed it as best she could, hugged him, and tried to still the rage which had him trembling. They were lost, both lost in the dark ways, and Big Fellow was horribly dead, and Bluetooth sat and hissed with pain and anger, muscles hard and quivering. But in a moment he shook himself, lipped at her cheek, shivered as she put her arms about him. "Oh, let us go home," he whispered. "Oh, let us go home, Tom Utsipitan, and no more see humans. No machines, no fields, no man work, only Hysa, always and always. Let us go home." She said nothing. The disaster was hers, for she had suggested, and Big Fellow had wanted her, and Bluetooth had risen to the challenge of his daring, as if they had been in the high hills. Her disaster, her doing. Now Bluetooth himself spoke of leaving her dream, unwilling to follow her further. Tears filled her eyes, doubts for herself, loneliness that she had walked too far. Now they were in worse trouble, for to find themselves they must go up again to the man places and open a door and beg help, and they had seen the result of that. They held each other and did not stir from where they were. Part 2. Mallory looked tired, a hollowness to her eyes as she paced the aisles of Command Central, countless circuits of it, while her troops stood guard. Damon watched her, himself leaning against the counter, hungry and tired himself, but it was, he reckoned, nothing to what the fleet personnel must be feeling, having gone through jump, passing from that to this tedious police duty. Workers, never relieved at their posts, looked haggard, muttered timid complaints, but there was no other shift for these troops. "Are you going to stay here all night?" he asked her. She turned a cold look on him, said nothing, walked on. He had watched her for some hours, a foreboding presence in the center. She had a way of moving that made no noise, no swagger, no, but it was perhaps the unconscious assumption that anyone in her way would move. They did. Any tech who had to get up did so only when Mallory was patrolling some other aisle. She had never made a threat, spoke seldom, mostly to the troopers, about what only she and they knew. She was even, occasionally, and before the hours wore on, pleasant. But there was no question a threat was there. Most residents on station had never seen close up the kind of gear that surrounded Mallory and her troops, had never touched a gun with their own hands, would be hard put to describe what they saw. He noted three different models in this small section alone, light pistol, long-barreled ones, heavy rifles, all black plastics and ominous symmetries, armor, to diffuse the burn of such weapons. That gave the troops the same deadly machined look as the rest of the gear, no longer human. It was impossible to relax with such among them. A tech rose at the far side of the room, looked over her shoulder as if to see if any of the guns had moved, walked down the aisle as if it were mined, gave him a printed message, retreated at once. Damon held the message in his hand, unread, conscious of Mallory's interest. She had stopped pacing. He found no way to avoid attention, unfolded the paper, and read it. PSSCIA/PACPAKONSTANT INDAMON/AU1-1-1-1-1/10/4/52/2136midday/0936A/start/tally papers confiscated and tally arrested by fleet order/. Sec office given choice, local detention or military intervention, / tally confined this post, / tally request message sent Constantine family, / herein complied, / request instruction, / request policy clarification, / Saunders, redone, seccom, / end it. He looked up, pulse racing, caught between relief it was nothing worse and distress for what it was. Mallory was looking straight at him, a curious, challenging interest on her face. She walked over to him. He considered an outright lie, hoping she would not insist on the message and make an issue of it. He considered what he knew of her and reckoned otherwise. "There's a friend of mine in trouble," he said. "I need to leave and go see about him."
"Trouble with us?"
He considered the lie a second time.
"Something like."
She held out her hand. He did not offer the message.
"Perhaps I can help."
Her eyes were cold, and her hand stayed extended, palm up.
"Do we assume," she asked when it was not forthcoming, "that this is something embarrassing to station, or do we make further assumptions?"
He handed over the paper, while there were choices at all. She scanned it, seemed perplexed for a moment, and gradually her face changed.
"Tally," she said.
"Josh Tally?"
He nodded, and she pursed her lips.
"A friend of the Constantines. How times do change."
"He's adjusted."
The eyes flickered.
"His own request," he said.
"What else did Russell leave him?"
She kept looking at him, and he wished that there were somewhere else to look and somewhere else to be.
Adjustment spilled things. It thrust Pell and her into an intimacy he did not want, which too clearly she did not want, those records on station.
"How is he?" she asked.
He found even the asking bizarrely ugly and simply stared.
"Friendship," she said.
"Friendship and from such opposite poles. Or is it patronage? He asked for adjustment, and you gave it to him, finished what Russell started. I detect offended sensibilities, do I not?"
"We're not Russell's."
A smile to which the eyes gave the lie. "How bright a world, Mr. Constantine, where there's still such outrage, and where Q exists on the same station, within arm's reach one of the other, and administered by your office, or maybe Q itself is misplaced compassion. I suspect you must have created that hell by half measures, by exercise of your sensibilities, your private object of outrage, this Unioner, your apology to morality, or your statement on the war, Mr. Constantine."
"I want him out of detention. I want his papers back. He has no politics any longer."
No one talked to Mallory that way. Plainly, no one did. After a long moment, she broke contact with his eyes, a dismissal, nodded slowly.
"You're accountable?"
"I make myself accountable."
"On that understanding, no, Mr. Constantine, you don't go. You don't need to go in person. I'll clear him through fleet channels. Send him home on your assurance things are as you say."
"You can see the records if you want."
"I'm sure they'd contain nothing of news."
She waved a hand, a signal to someone behind him, a tiny move. His spine crawled with the sudden realization there had been a gun at his back. She walked over to the comm console, leaned over the tech, and keyed through to the fleet channel.
"This is Mallory. Release the papers and person of Joshua Tally in station detention. Relay to appropriate authorities, fleet and station. Over."
The acknowledgement came back, impersonal and uninterested.
"May I," Damon asked her,
"may I send a call to him? He'll need some clear instruction."
"Sir," one of the techs nearby said, facing about in her place.
"Sir."
He glanced distractedly at the anguished face.
"A downer's been shot, sir, in Green 4.
The breath went out of him. For a moment, his mind refused to work.
"He's dead, sir."
He shook his head, sick at his stomach, turned and glared at Mallory.
"They don't hurt anything. No downer ever lifted a hand to a human except to escape in panic, ever."
Mallory shrugged. "Past mending now, Mr. Constantine. Get on about your own business. Someone slipped and fired. There was a no-shoot order. It's our business, not yours. Our own people will take care of it."
"They're people, Captain."
"We've shot people, too," Mallory said, unruffled.
"Get on about your business, I say. This matter is under martial law, and I'll settle it."
He stood still. Everywhere in the center, faces were turned toward them, and the boards flashed with neglected lights.
"Get to work," he ordered them sharply, and backs turned at once. "Get a station medic to that area."
"You try my patience," Mallory said.
"They are our citizens."
"Your citizenship is broad, Mr. Constantine."
"I'm telling you, they're terrified of violence.
If you want chaos on this station, Captain, panic the downers. She considered the point, nodded finally, without rancor. If you can mend the situation, Mr. Constantine, see to it, and go where you choose. Just that. Go. He started away, glanced back with sudden dread of Mallory, who could cast away a public argument. He had lost, had let anger get the better of him. And go, she said, as if her pride were nothing. He left, with a disturbed feeling that he had done something desperately dangerous. Clear Damon Constantine for passage, Mallory's voice thundered through the corridors, and troops who had made to challenge him did not. Part 3. He ran, leaving the lift on Green 4, his ID and card in hand, flashed both at a zealous trooper who tried to bar his way and won through. Troops were gathered ahead, blocking off all view. He ran up and roughly seized, showed the card, and pushed his way past the troopers. Damon. He heard Aline's voice before he saw her, swung about and met her arms in the press of armored troops, hugged her in relief. It's one of the temporaries, she said. A male named Bigfellow. Dead. Get out of here, he wished her, not trusting the troop's good sense. He looked beyond her. There was a good deal of blood on the floor at the access doorway. They had gotten the dead downer into a body bag and onto a stretcher for removal. Aline, her arm linked with his, showed no inclination to leave. Doors got him, she said, but the shot may have killed him first. Lieutenant Vanas off India, she murmured, for a young officer urged his way toward them, in charge of this unit. What happened? Damon asked the lieutenant. What happened here? Mr. Constantine, a regrettable error. The downer appeared unexpectedly. This is Pell, Lieutenant, full of civilians. The station will want a full report on this. For the safety of your station, Mr. Constantine, I'd urge you to review your security procedures. Your workers blew the lock. That cut the downer in half when the emergency seal went. Someone had that inner door open out of sequence. How far do these tunnels go? Everywhere? They've run, Aline said quickly. Down, away from here. They're probably temporaries, and they don't know the tunnels well, and they're not about to come out again with the threat of guns out here. They'll hide down there till they die. Order them out, Vanar said. You don't understand the downers, Damon said. Get them all out of the tunnels. Seal them up. Pell's maintenance is in those tunnels, Lieutenant, and our downer workers live in that network with their own atmospheric system. The tunnels can't shut down. I'm going in there, he said to Aline. They may answer. She bit her lip. I'm staying right here, she said, till you come out. There were objections he would have made. It was not the place for them. He shot a look at Vanar's. It may take me a while. Downers aren't a negotiable matter on Pell. They're frightened, and they can get into places they can die in and cause us real trouble. If I get into trouble, contact station authorities. Don't send troops in. We can deal with them. If another gun goes off in their vicinity, we may not have a maintenance system, sir. Our life support and theirs are linked. A system in precise balance. Vanar said nothing, did not react. It was impossible to know if reason meant anything with him or the rest of them. He squeezed Aline's hand, drew away, and shouldered his way past the armored troops, tried to avoid stepping in a dark pool of blood as he carted open the lock. The door opened, closed behind him, started its cycle automatically. He reached for the human breathing gear, which always hung on the right of entry of such chambers, slipped it on before the effects became severe. His breath took on the suck and hiss he associated subconsciously with downer presence, loud in the metal chamber. He opened the inner door, and the echo came back out of far depths. He had a dim blue light where he was, but he paused to unlock the compartment by the door and take out a lamp. The powerful beam cut through the dark into a web of steel. Downers, he called, his voice echoing hollowly down and down. He felt the cold as he walked through the door and let it seal, stood on the joining platform from which the ladders ran in all directions. Downers, it's Damon Constantine. Do you hear me? Call out if you hear me. The echoes died very slowly, depth upon depth. Downers? A moan drifted up out of the dark, an echoing keening which stirred the hairs at his nape. Anger? He went further, gripping the light with one hand, the thin rail with the other, stopped and listened. Downers? Something moved in the dark depths. Soft footfalls rang very softly on metal far below. Constantine? An alien voice lisped. Constantine, man? It's Damon Constantine, he called again. Please come up. No guns. It's safe. He stayed still, feeling the slight tremor in the scaffolding as feet trod it far down in the dark. He heard breathing, and his eyes caught the light far below, shimmer like illusion. There was an impression of fur and another glimmer of eyes ascending by stages. He stayed very still, one man, and fragile in these dark places. They were not dangerous, but no one had attacked them with guns before. They came, more distinct in his handheld light, bedraggled and struggling up the last stage, panting, the one hurt and the other wide-eyed with terror. Constantine, man, that one said with a quavering lisp, help, help, help. They held out hands, pleading. He set the lamp down on the grating on which he stood and accepted them as children, touched the nail very carefully, for the poor fellow was bleeding all down his arm, and drew back his lips in a fretful snarl. All right, he assured them. You're safe now. I'll get you out. Scared, Constantine, man. The female stroked her mate's shoulder and looked from one to the other of them with round, shadowed eyes. All hide gone, find no path. I don't understand you. More we, dead hungry, dead afraid, please help we. Call them. She touched the male, a gesture eloquent of worry. The male chattered something to her, pushed at her, and she reached untouched at Damon. I'll wait, Damon assured her. I wait here. All safe. Love you, she said in a breath, and scrambled back down with a ringing of the metal steps, lost at once in the dark. In a moment more, shrieks and trills sounded out into the depths until the echoes redoubled. Voices woke out of other places, male and female, deep and high, until all the depths and dark went mad. A shriek erupted by him. The male shouted something down. They came in the silence which followed, ringing of steps on the metal deep below, callings occasionally echoing sharply, and moanings rising, which stirred the scalp. The female came running back to stroke her mate's shoulder and to touch his hands. I satin. I call. Nicky, all right, Constantine, man. They have to come through the lock a few at a time, you understand. Careful of a lock. I know lock, she said. I careful. Go, go, I bring they. She was already hastening down again. Damon put his arm about the male and brought him into the lock, dragged his mask up for him, for the fellow was muzzy with shock, snarling with pain, but making no attempt to snap or strike. The next door opened on the flare of light and armed men, and the downer started within the circle of his arm, snarled and spat, yielded to a reassuring hug. Eileen was there, breaking through the troops, holding her hands out to help. Get the troops back, Damon snapped, light-blinded and unable to distinguish Vanar's. Out of the way! Quit waving guns at them! He urged the downer to sit on the floor by the wall, and Eileen was ordering the medic over. Back these troops out of here, Damon said again. Leave us to it. An order was passed. To his great relief, the India troopers began to pull back, and the downer sat still, with some persuasion, yielded his injured arm to examination as the medic knelt down with his kit. Damon tugged his own mask down, stifling in it, squeezed Aline's hand as she bent down beside him. The air stank of sweating, frightened downer, a pungent muskiness. Name's Bluetooth, the medic said, checking the tag. He made a few swift notes and began gently to treat the injury. Burn and hemorrhage, minor except for shock. Drink, Bluetooth pleaded, and reached for the kit. The medic rescued it and quietly promised him water when they could find some. The lock opened, yielded up a near dozen downers. Damon stood up, reading panic in their looks. I'm Constantine, he said at once, for the name carried importance with the downers. He met them with outstretched hands, suffered himself to be hugged by sweating, shock-hazed downers, gentle enfoldings of powerful furred arms. Eileen welcomed them likewise, and in a moment another lockful had spilled out, making a knot which filled the corridor and outnumbered the troops who stood in the end of the hall. The Downers cast anxious looks in that direction, but kept together. Another lockful and Bluetooth's mate was with them, chattering anxiously until she had found him. Varnars came among them, quite without swagger in this brown-furred flood. "You're requested to get them to a secure area as quickly as possible," Varnars said. "Use your comm and clear us passage via the emergency ramps via 4 through 9 to the docks," Damon said. "Their habitat is accessible from there. We'll escort them back. That's quickest and safest for all concerned." He did not wait for Varnars' comment in the matter, but waved an arm at the Downers. "Come," he said, and they fell silent and began to move. Bluetooth, his arm done up in a white bandage, scrambled up not to be left and chattered something to the others. Satin added her own voice, and there was a general and sudden cheerfulness among the Downers. He walked hand in hand with Eileen, and the Downers strode along about and behind them with the peculiar accompaniment of the breather sounds, moving gladly and quickly. The few guards along their route stayed very still, suddenly in the minority, and Downers chattered with increasing freedom among themselves as they reached the end of the hall and entered the spiraling broad ramp which led to doors on all the 9 levels. An arm snaked about Damon's left as they descended. He looked, and it was Bluetooth, and Satin was with him, so that they came 4 abreast down the ramp, bizarre company. 5, for another had joined hands with Eileen on the right. Satin cried something. A chorus answered. Again she spoke, her voice echoing in the heights and depths, and again the chattering chorus thundered out with a bounce in steps about them. Another yelled from the rear, and voices answered, and a second time. Damon tightened his hand on Eileen's, at once stirred and alarmed at this behavior, but the Downers were content to walk with him, shouting what had begun to sound like a marching chant. They broke into Green 9 and marched down the long hall, entered the docks with a great shout, and the echoes rang. The line of troops which guarded the ship accesses stirred ominously, but no more than that. "Stay with me," Damon ordered his companion sternly, and they did so, up the curving horizon into the area of their habitat, and there to a parting. "Go," he told them. "Go, and mind you, be careful. Don't scare the men with guns." He had expected them to run, scampering free, as they had begun to do about him. But one by one they came and wished to hug him and Eileen, with tender care, so that the parting took some little time. Last, Satin and Bluetooth, who hugged and patted them. "Love you," Bluetooth said. "Love you," said Satin in her turn. No word, no question about the dead one. "Big fellow was lost," Damon told them, although he was sure by Bluetooth's burn that they had been somewhere involved in the matter. "Dead." Satin bobbed a solemn agreement. "You send he home, Constantine man." "I'll send," he promised. "Humans died and did not merit transport. They had no strong ties to this soil, or to any soil, a vague, distressed desire toward burying, but not at inconvenience. This was inconvenient, but so was it to be murdered far from home. I'll see it's done." "Love you," she said solemnly, and hugged him a second time, laid her hand most gently on Eileen's belly, and walked away with Bluetooth, running after a moment to the lock which led to their own tunnels. It left Eileen standing with her own hand to her stomach and a dazed stare at him. "How could she know?" Eileen asked, with a bewildered laugh. It disturbed him, too. "It shows a little," he said. "To one of them?" "They don't get large," he said, and looking past her to the docks and the lines of troops. "Come on, I don't like this area." She looked where he had, to the soldiers and the more motley groups which ranged the upcurving horizon of the docks, near the bars and restaurants. Merchanters, keeping an eye on the military, on a dock which had been taken away from them. "Merchanters have owned this place since Pell began," she said, "and the bars and the sleepovers. Establishments are shutting down, and Mazian's troops won't be happy. Freighter crews and Mazians in one bar, in one sleepover. Station security had better be tight when any of those troops go on liberty." Come on, he said, taking her arm. I want you out of this. Running out here, going out into that corridor with the downers. Where were you? She shot back. Down in the tunnels.
I know them.
So I know the docks.
So what were you doing up in four?
I was down here when the call came. I asked Hugh for a pass and got one. Got his lieutenant to cooperate with dock officers. I was doing my job, thank you. And when the call came through Fleet Comm, I got Vanars up there before someone else got shot.
He hugged her gratefully, walked with her around the turn into Blue 9, another barren vista of troops stationed at intervals and no one in the corridors.
Josh, he said suddenly, dropping his arm.
What?
He kept his pace, headed for the lift, gathered his papers from his pocket, but they were India troops and they were waved through. Josh got picked up. Mallory knows he's here and where he is.
What are you going to do about it?
Mallory agreed to release him. They may have let him loose already. I've got to check comp and find out where he is, whether still in detention or back at his apartment.
He could sleep over with us.
He said nothing, thinking about that.
Which of us, she asked, is really going to sleep easy otherwise?
Not much sleep with him around, either. We'll be jammed up in that apartment, as good as having him in bed with us.
So I've slept crowded. So it could drag on more than one night. If they get their hands on him...
Eileen, it's one thing if Station handles a protest. There are things in this, personal things, with Josh.
Secrets?
Things that don't bear the light. Things Mallory might not want out, you understand me? She's dangerous. I've talked to multiple murderers less cold-blooded.
Fleet Captain, it's a breed, Damon. Ask any merchanter.
You know there are probably kin of the merchanters on Station standing in those lines, but they'll not break formation to hail their own mothers, no. What the fleet takes doesn't come back.
You don't tell me anything I don't know about the fleet. I can tell you that if we want to do something, we should do it. Now.
If we bring him in with us, we risk having that act in fleet files.
I think I know what you want to do.
She had her own stubbornness. He reckoned matters, stopped at the lift, his hand on the button.
I figure we'd better get him, he said.
So, she said, thought so. Chapter 7, Part 1, PAL, Sector White 4, 2230 hours. John Lucas walked nervously through the vacant halls, despite the pass Q had given to all of them in the council chambers. Troops might be withdrawn progressively, starting at main dawn, they had been promised. Had to, he reckoned. Some of them were already being rotated off to rest, some fleet crew, armorless, taking up guard in their places. It was all quiet. He was not even challenged but once at the lift exit, and he walked to his door, used his card to open it. The front room was deserted. His heart lurched with the immediate fear that his unbidden guest had strayed, but then Bran Hale appeared in the hall by the kitchen and looked relieved to see him.
All right, Hale said, and Jessad came out, and two others of Hale's men after him.
About time, Jessad said. This was growing tedious.
It's going to stay that way, John said peevishly. Everyone has to stay here tonight, Hale, Daniels, Clay. I'm not having my apartment door pour a horde of visitors out under the troops' noses. They'll be gone come morning.
The fleet? Hale asked.
The troops in the halls.
John went to the kitchen bar, examined a bottle which had been full when he left it, and which now had two fingers remaining. He poured himself a drink and sipped it with a sigh, his eyes stinging with exhaustion. He walked over to the chair he favored and sank down as Jessad took his place opposite, across the low table, and Hale and his men rummaged at the bar for another bottle.
I'm glad you were prudent, he said to Jessad. I was worried.
Jessad smiled, cat-eyed.
I surmise you were.
That for a moment or two you thought of solutions. Maybe you're still thinking in that line. Shall we discuss it?
John frowned, slid a glance at Hale and his men.
I trust them more than you, and that's a fact.
It's likely you thought of being rid of me, Jessad said. And I wouldn't be surprised if you aren't right now more concerned about where rather than if. You might get away with it entirely. Probably you would.
The directness disturbed him.
Since you bring it up yourself, I suppose you've got a counter-proposal.
The smile persisted.
One, I'm no present hazard. You may want to think matters over. Two, I am undismayed by Mazian's arrival.
Why?
Because that contingency is covered.
John lifted the glass to his lips and took a stinging swallow.
By what?
When you jump to land in the deep, Mr. Lucas, you can do it three safe ways. Not throw much into the jump in the first place, if you're in regions you know very, very well, or use a star's G to pull you up, or if you're good, the mass in some null point. A lot of junk in Pell's vicinity, you know that? Nothing very big, but big enough.
What are you talking about?
The Union fleet, Mr. Lucas. Do you think there's no reason Mazian has his ships grouped for the first time in decades? Pell's all they have left, and the Union fleet is out there just as they sent me ahead, knowing where they'd come.
Hale and his men had gathered, settled on the couch and along the back of it. John shaped the situation in his mind. Pell, a battle zone, the worst of all scenarios.
And what happens to us when it's discovered there's no way to dislodge Mazian?
Mazian can be driven off, and when that's done, he has no bases at all. He's done, and we have peace, Mr. Lucas, with all the rewards of it. That's why I'm here.
I'm listening.
Officials have to be taken out. The Constantines have to be taken out. You have to be set in their place. Have you the nerve for that, Mr. Lucas, despite relationships? I understand there's a kinship involved here. Yourself, Constantine's wife.
He clamped his lips together, flinching as he always did, from the thought of Alicia as she was now.
Could not face that. Had never been able to stomach it.
It was not life linked to those machines. Not life.
He wiped at his face.
My sister and I don't speak, haven't for years. She's an invalid.
Dayan would have told you that.
I'm aware of it. I'm talking about her husband, her sons.
Have you the nerve, Mr. Lucas?
Nerve, yes, if the planning makes sense.
There's a man on this station named Kresich.
He sucked in a slow breath, the drink resting in his hand against the chair arm.
Vasily Kresich, elected councillor of Q. How do you know him?
Dayan Jacoby gave us the name as the councillor from that zone, and we have files. This man, Kresich, comes from Q when the council meets. He then has a pass which will let him do so, or is it visual inspection?
Both. There are guards.
Can those who do the inspecting be bribed?
For some things, yes. But stationers, Mr. Whoever you are, have a natural reluctance to doing anything to damage the station they're living in. You can get drugs and liquor into Q, but a man, a guard's conscience about a case of liquor and his instinct for self-preservation are two different things.
Then we'll have to keep any conference with him brief, won't we?
Not here.
That's up to you. Perhaps the lending of an ID and papers. I'm sure among your many faithful employees something can be arranged, some apartment near the Q zone.
What kind of conference are you talking about, and what are you looking for from Kresich? The man is spineless.
How many employees do you have in all, Jess had asked, as faithful and trusted as these men here, men who might take risks, who might kill? We have need of that sort.
John cast a look at Bran Hale, feeling short of breath.
Back again.
Well, Kresich isn't the type, I'll tell you.
Kresich has contacts. Can a man stay seated atop that monster of Q without them?
Part 2. Pell, Sector Green 7, Merchanter's Hospice, 2241 hours.
Calm buzzed. The light was on, a call coming through.
Josh looked at it across his room, stopped in his pacing.
They had let him go.
Go home, they had said, and he had done so, through corridors guarded by police and Maziani. They knew at this moment where he was, and now someone was calling his room hard after his arrival. The caller insisted. The red light stayed on, blinking. He did not want to answer, but it might be detention, checking to be sure he had gotten here. He was afraid not to respond to it. He crossed the room and pushed the reply button.
Josh Talley, he said, into the mic.
Josh, it's Damon. Good to hear your voice. Are you all right?
He leaned against the wall, caught his breath.
Josh?
I'm all right.
Damon, you know what happened?
I know. Your message got to me. I've taken personal responsibility for you. You're coming to our apartment tonight. Pack what you need. I'm coming there after you. Damon, no. No, stay out of this. We've talked it over. It's all right. No argument. Damon, don't. Don't let it get on their records. We're your legal sponsors as it is, Josh. It's already on the records. Don't. Eileen and I are on our way. The contact went dead. He wiped his face. The knot which had been in his stomach had risen into his throat. He saw no walls, nothing of where he was. It was all metal, and Sidney Mallory, young face and aged silvered hair, and eyes dead, and oldest of all, Damon and Eileen, and the child they wanted. They prepared to put everything at risk for him. He had no weapons, needed none, if it were to be himself and her alone, as it had been in her quarters. He had been dead then, inside. Had existed, hating his existence. The same kind of paralysis beckoned now, to let things be, accept, take cover where it was offered. It was always easier. He had not threatened Mallory, having had nothing to fight for. He pushed from the wall, felt of his pocket, making sure his papers were there. He walked into the hall and through it, past the unmanned front desk of the hospice, out into the open where the guards stood. One of the local security started to challenge him. He looked frantically down the corridor where a trooper stood. "You!" he shouted, disturbing the vacant quiet of the hall. Police and trooper reacted, the trooper with leveled rifle and a suddenness which had almost been a pulled trigger. Josh swallowed thickly, held his hands in plain view. "I want to talk with you." The rifle motioned. He walked with hands still wide at his sides, toward the armored trooper and the dark muzzle. "Far enough," the trooper said. "What is it?" The insignia was Atlantic's. "Mallory of Norway," he said. "We're good friends. Tell her Josh Talley wants to talk with her. Now." The trooper had a disbelieving look, a scowl, finally, but he balanced the rifle in the crook of his arm and reached for his comm button. "I'll relay to the Norway duty officer," he said. "You'll be going in either case, your way if she does know you, and on general investigation if she doesn't." "She'll see me," he said. The trooper pushed the comm button and queried. What came back came privately over his helmet comm, but his eyes flickered. "Check it then," he said to Norway. And after a moment more, "Command Central, got it, out." He hooked the comm unit to his belt again and motioned with the rifle barrel. "Keep walking down that hall and go up the ramp. That trooper down there will take you in charge and see you talk to Mallory." He went, walking quickly, for he did not reckon it would take Damon and Eileen long to reach the hospice. They searched him. Of course they would do so. He endured it for the third time this day, and this time it did not bother him. He was cold inside, and outer things did not trouble him. He straightened his clothes and walked with them up the ramp, past sentries at every level. On green two, they entered a lift and rode it the short rise and traverse into blue one. They had not even asked for his papers, had scarcely looked at them more than to be sure that the folder held nothing but papers. They walked a short distance back along the matting-carpeted hall. There was a reek of chemicals in the air. Workmen were busy peeling all the location signs. The windowed section further, crammed with comp equipment and with a few techs moving about, was specially guarded. Norway troops. They opened the door and let him and his guards in, into Station Central, among the aisles of busy technicians. Mallory, seated at the end of the counters, rose to meet him, smiled coldly at him, her face haggard. "Well," she said. He had thought the sight of her would not affect him. It did. His stomach wrenched. "I want to come back," he said, "on Norway." "Do you?" "I'm no stationer. I don't belong here. Who else would take me?" Mallory looked at him and said nothing. A tremor started in his left knee. He wished he might sit down. They would shoot him if he made a move. He thoroughly believed that they would. The tick threatened his composure, jerked at the side of his mouth when she turned away a moment and glanced back again. She laughed, a dry chuckle. "Constantine put you up to this?" "No." "You've been adjusted. That so?" The stammer tied his tongue. He nodded. and Constantine makes himself responsible for your good behavior. It was all going wrong. No one's responsible for me, he said, stumbling on the words. I want a ship. If Norway is all I've got, then I'll take it. He had to look at her directly, at eyes which flickered with imagined thoughts, things which were not going to be said here before the troopers. You search him? She asked the guards. Yes, ma'am. She stood thinking a long moment, and there was no smile, no laughter. Where are you staying? A room in the old hospice. The Constantines provide it? I work. I pay for it. What's your job? Small salvage. An expression of surprise, of derision. So I want out of it, he said. I figure you owe me that. There was interruption, movement behind him, which stopped. Mallory laughed, a bored, weary laugh, and beckoned to someone. Constantine, come on in. Come get your friend. Josh turned. Damon and Aline were both there, flushed and upset and out of breath. They had followed him. If he's confused, Damon said, he belongs in the hospital. He came and laid a hand on Josh's shoulder. Come on. Come on, Josh. He's not confused, Mallory said. He came here to kill me. Take your friend home, Mr. Constantine, and keep a watch on him, or I'll handle matters my way. There was stark silence. I'll see to it, Damon said after a moment. His fingers bit into Josh's shoulders. Come on. Come on. Josh moved. Walked with him and Aline past the guards out and down the long corridor with the work crews and the chemical smell. The doors of Central closed behind them. Neither of them said anything. Damon's grip shifted to his elbow and they took him into a lift, rode it down the short distance to 5. There were more guards in this hall and station police. They passed unchallenged into the residential halls to Damon's own door. They brought him inside and closed the door. He stood waiting while Damon and Aline went to the routine of turning on lights and taking off jackets. I'll send for your clothes, Damon said shortly. Come on, make yourself at home. It was not the welcome he deserved. He picked a leather chair, mindful of his grease-stained work clothes. Aline brought him a cool drink, and he sipped at it without tasting it. Damon sat down on the arm of the chair next to his. Temper showed. Josh accepted that, found a place at his feet to stare at. You ran us a circular chase, Damon said. I don't know how you got past us, but you managed it. I asked to go. Whatever Damon would have wanted to say, he swallowed. Aline came over and sat down on the couch opposite him. So what did you have in mind? Damon asked evenly. You shouldn't have gotten involved. I didn't want you involved. So you ran from us? He shrugged. Josh, did you mean to kill her? Eventually. Somewhere. Sometime. They found nothing to say. Damon finally shook his head and looked away, and Aline came over behind Josh's chair, laid a gentle hand on his shoulder. It didn't work, Josh said finally, tripping on the words. It went every way wrong. I'm afraid now she thinks you put me up to it. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Aline's hand brushed his hair, descended again to his shoulder. Damon simply stared at him as if he were looking at someone he had never seen before. Don't you ever, Damon said, think of doing that again. I didn't want you to hurt. I didn't want you taking me in with you. Think how it looks to them, you with me. You think Maisie runs this station all of a sudden? And you think a captain in the fleet is going to break relations with the Constantines, whose cooperation Maisie needs, in a personal feud? He thought that over. It made sense in a way he wanted to believe, and therefore he suspected it. It's not going to happen, Damon said. So forget about it. No trooper is about to walk into this apartment. You can depend on it. Just don't give them excuses for wanting to. And you came close. You understand that? The worst thing you can do is give them a pretext. Josh, it was Mallory's order that got you out of detention. I asked it. She did it a second time back there as a favor. Don't depend on a third. He nodded, shaken. Have you eaten today? He considered, confused, finally thought back to the sandwich, realized that at least part of his malaise was lack of food. "Missed supper," he said. "I'll get you some clothes of mine that will fit. Wash up, relax. We'll go back to your apartment tomorrow morning and get whatever you need." "How long am I going to stay here?" he asked, turning his head to look at Aline and back at Damon. It was a small place. He was aware of the inconvenience. "I can't move in on you." "You stay here until it's safe," Damon said. "If we have to make further arrangements, we will. In the meantime, I'm going to do some review on your papers, or whatever excuse I can contrive that will excuse your spending the next few working days in my office." "I don't go back to the shop?" "When this is settled. Meanwhile, we're not going to let you out of our sight. We make it clear they'll have to create a major incident to touch you. I'll put my father onto it, too, so that no one in either office gets caught by a surprise request. Just please, don't provoke anything." "No," he agreed. Damon gave a jerk of his head back toward the hall. He rose and went with Damon, and Damon searched an armload of clothing out of the lockers outside the bath. He went into the bath, bathed, and felt better, clean of the memory of the detention cell, wrapped himself in the soft robe Damon had lent him, and came out to the aroma of supper cooking. They ate, crowded at the table, exchanged what they had seen in their separate sections. He could talk without anxiousness finally, now that the nightmare was on him, and he was no longer alone in it. He chose the far corner of the kitchen, made himself a pallet on the floor, out of the amazing abundance of bedding Aline urged on him. "We'll get a cot by tomorrow," she promised him, "at the least a hammock." He settled down in it, heard them settle in the living room, and felt safe, believing finally what Damon had told him, that he was in a refuge even Maisian's fleet could not breach. Chapter 8. Down below, Africa Landing Probe, Main Base, 2400 hours main day, 1200 hours alter day, local daylight. Amelia leaned back in the chair and stared resolutely at Pori's scowl, waited, while the scarred captain made several notes on the printout before him and pushed it back across the table at him. Amelia gathered it up, leafed through the supply request, nodded slowly. "It may take a little time," he said. "At the moment," said Pori, "I am simply relaying reports and acting on instructions. You and your staff are not cooperating. Go on with that as long as you please." They sat in a small personnel area of Pori's ship, flat-decked, never meant for prolonged spaceflight. Pori had had his taste of down-below air and of their domes and the dust and the mud, and retreated to his ship in disgust, calling him in instead of visiting the main dome. And that would have suited him well if it had only taken the troops away as well. It had not. They were still outside, masked and armed. Q and the residents as well worked the fields under guns. "I also am receiving instructions," Amelia said, "and acting on them. The best that we can do, Captain, is to acknowledge that both sides are aware of the situation, and your reasonable request will be honored. We are both under orders." A reasonable man might have been placated. Pori was not. He simply scowled. Perhaps he resented the order which had put him on down below. Perhaps it was his natural expression. Likely he was short of sleep. The short intervals at which the troops outside were being relieved indicated they had not come in fresh, and Pori's crew had been in evidence, not Pori. Alternate crew, perhaps. "Take your time," Pori repeated, and it was evident that he would remember the time taken, the day that he had the chance to do things his own way. "By your leave," Emilio said, received no courtesy, and stood up and walked out. The guards let him go, down the short corridor and via lift to the ship's big belly, where lift functioned as lock, into down-below atmosphere. He drew up his mask and walked down the lowered ramp into the cool wind. They had not yet sent occupation forces to the other camps. He reckoned that they would like to, but that their forces were limited, and there were no landing areas at those sites. As for Pori's demand for supplies, he reckoned he could come up with the requested amount. It scanted them, certainly scanted station, but their balking and the stripped domes, he reckoned, had at least gotten the fleet's demand down to something tolerable. Situation improved, his father's most recent message had been. No evacuation planned. Fleet contemplating permanent base at Pell. That was not the best news. It was not the worst. All his life he had figured on the war as a debt which had to come due some day in some generation, that Pell could not keep its neutrality forever. While the company agents had been with them, he had hoped, forlornly, that some outside force might be prepared to intervene. It was not. They had Mazian instead, who was losing the war Earth would not finance, who could not protect a station that might decide to finance him, who knew nothing of Pell and cared nothing for down below's delicate balances. "Where are the downers?" the troops had asked. Frightened by strangers, he had answered. There was no sign of them. He did not plan that there should be. He tucked Puri's supply request into his jacket pocket and walked the path up and over the hill. He could see the troops standing here and there among the domes, rifles evident, could see the workers far off among the fields, all of them, turned out to work, regardless of schedules or age or health. Troops were down at the mill, at the pumping station. They were asking questions among the workers about production rates. So far, it had not shaken the basic story. That station had simply absorbed what they produced. There were all those ships up there, all those merchanters orbiting station. It was not likely that even Mazian would start singling out merchanters and taking supply from them, not when they were that numerous. But Mazian, the thought kept nagging at him, had not outmaneuvered Union this long to be taken in by Emilio Constantine. Not likely. He walked the path down over the bridge in the gully, up again toward operations. He saw its door open, saw Miliko come outside, stand waiting for him, her black hair blowing, her arms clenched against the day's chill. She had wanted to come to the ship with him, fearing his going alone into Pori's hands without witnesses. He had argued her out of it. She started toward him now, coming down the hill, and he waved to let her know it was at least as all right as it was likely to be. They were still in command of down below. Chapter 9. Blue 1, 10-5-52, 0900. A trooper was on guard at the corner. John Lucas hesitated, but that was guaranteed to attract attention. The trooper made a move of his hand to the vicinity of the pistol. John came ahead nervously, card in hand, offered it, and the trooper, heavy-set, dark-skinned, took it and frowned while looking at it. "That's a council clearance," John said. "Top council clearance." "Yes, sir," the trooper said. John took the card back, started down the cross hall with the feeling that the trooper was still watching his back. "Sir?" He turned. "Mr. Constantine's at his office, sir." "His wife's my sister." There was a moment of silence. "Yes, sir," the trooper said mildly, and made himself a statue again. John turned and walked on. Angelo did well for himself, he thought bitterly. No crowding here, no giving up of his living space. The whole end of Cross Hall 4 was Angelo's and Alicia's. He stopped at the door, hesitated, his stomach tightening. He had gotten this far. There was a trooper back there who would ask questions, make an issue of unusual behavior. There was no going back. He pressed calm, waited. "Who?" a reedy voice asked, startling him. "Who you?" "Lucas," he said. "John Lucas." The door opened. A thin, grayed downer frowned up at him from eyes surrounded with wrinkles. "I, Lily," she said. He brushed past her, stepped in, and looked about the dim living room, the costly furniture, the luxury, the space of it. The downer Lily hovered there, anxious, let the door close. He turned, his eyes drawn to light, saw a room beyond, a white floor, with the illusion of windows open on space. "You come see she?" Lily asked. "Tell her I'm here." "I tell." The old downer bowed, walked away with a stooped, brittle step. The place was quiet, deathly hushed. He waited in the dark living room, found nothing to do with his hands, his stomach more and more upset. There were voices from the room. "John," he heard in the midst of it, Alicia's voice. At least it was the human one. He shivered, feeling physically ill. He had never come to these rooms, never. Had seen Alicia by remote, tiny, withered, a shell the machine sustained. He came now. He did not know why he came, and did know. To find out what was truth, to know if he could face dealing with Alicia, if it was life worth living. All these years, the pictures, the transmitted cold pictures he could somehow deal with, but to be there in the same room, to look into her face and have to talk with her. Lily came back, hands folded, bowed. "You come. You come now." He moved, got as far as halfway to the white-tiled room, the sterile, hushed room, and his stomach knotted. Suddenly he turned and started for the outside door. "You come?" The downer's puzzled voice pursued him. "You come, sir?" He touched the switch and left, let the door close behind him, drew a breath of the cooler, freer air of the hall outside. He walked away from it, the place, the Constantines. "Mr. Lucas," the trooper on guard said as he reached the corner, his eyes asking curious questions through the courtesy. "She was asleep," he said, swallowed, kept walking, trying with every step to put that apartment and that white room out of his mind. He remembered a child, a girl, someone else. He kept it that way. Chapter 10, Part 1. Pell, Sector Blue 1, Council Chambers, 10-6-52, 1400 hours. Council was breaking up early, having passed what measures were set before it to pass, with Q of India sitting in grim witness of what they said and what they did, his stone-still countenance casting a pall on debate. On this third day of the crisis, Mazian made his demands and obtained. Cressett gathered up his notes and came down from the uppermost tier into the sunken center of the chambers by the seats about the table, delayed there, resisting the outflow of traffic, looking anxiously toward Angelo Constantine, who conferred with Nguyen and Landgraf and some of the other representatives. Q still sat at the table, listening, his bronzed face like a mask. He feared Q, feared to raise his business in front of him. But he went, nevertheless, edged insistently as close as he could get to the head of it, into that private company about Constantine where he knew he was not wanted, Q's representative, reminder of problems no one had time to solve. He waited while Constantine finished his discussion with the others, stared at Constantine intently, so that Constantine should be aware that his particular attention was wanted. At last, Constantine took note of him, stayed a moment from his evident intention to leave in Q's company, for Q had risen. "Sir," Cressett said, "Mr. Constantine." He drew from his folder of papers one which he had prepared, proffered it to Constantine's hand. "I have limited facilities, Mr. Constantine. Comp and print isn't accessible to me where I live. You know that. The situation there..." He moistened his lips, conscious of Constantine's frown. "My office was nearly mobbed last night. Please, sir, can we assure my constituents that the down-below appointments will continue?" "That's under negotiation, Mr. Cressett. The station is making every effort to get procedures back to normal, but programs are being reviewed. Policy and directions are being reviewed." "It's the only hope." He avoided Q's stare, kept his eyes fixed on Constantine. "Without that, we've got no hope. Our people will go to down below, to the fleet, to any place that will take them. Only the applications have to be accepted. They have to see there's hope of getting out. Please, sir." "The nature of this?" Constantine asked, lifting the paper to view. "A bill I haven't the facilities to reproduce for the council to consider. I hoped your staff..." "Regarding the applications." "Regarding that, sir." "The program remains," Q interrupted coldly, "under discussion." "We'll try," Constantine said, placing the paper among the others he held. "I can't bring this up on the floor, Mr. Cressett. You understand that. Not until the basic issues in question are resolved at other levels. I'll have to hold it, and I earnestly beg that you don't bring up the question tomorrow, although, of course, you can do that. Public debate might upset negotiations. You're a man experienced in government. You understand me. But in courtesy, if we can bring this up at some future meeting, I'll, of course, have my staff prepare this or other bills for distribution. You understand my position, sir." "Yes, sir," he said, sick at heart. "Thank you." He turned away. He had hoped, dimly. He had hoped also for a chance to appeal for station help, security, protection. He did not want Q's sort of protection, dared not ask. They had seen the fleet's mercy in the persons of Mallory and Sung and Kreshov. The troops would come in, take Kaledi's organization apart as a beginning, his security, all the protection he had. He walked out into the council chamber's foyer, past the mocking, amazed stares of down-below statues, out the glass doors into the hall, and, unmolested by the guards, walked toward the lift which would take him down to the Blue Niner level to go home, back to Q. There was something like normal traffic in the corridors of Main Station now, thinner than usual, but station residents were back about their jobs and moving freely, if cautiously. No one tended to linger anywhere. Someone jostled him in meeting. A hand met his, pressed a card into it. He stopped, with a confused impression of a man, a face he had not bothered to see. In terror, he resisted the impulse to look about. He pretended to adjust the papers in his folder, walked on, and farther down the hall examined the card. An access card, a bit of tape on its surface. Green 90434. An address. He kept walking, dropped the hand with the card to his side, his heart hammering against his ribs. He could ignore it, pass on back into Q, could turn the card in, claim to have found it, or tell the truth, that someone wanted to contact him without others' knowledge. Politics. It had to be. Someone willing to take a risk wanted something from the representative of Q. A trap. Or hope. A trade of influence. Someone who might be able to move obstructions. He could reach Green 9, just an accidental wrong button on the lift. He stopped in front of a lift call plate, alone, coated green, and stood in front of the panel so no one passing might notice the glowing green. The car came, the doors opened. He stepped in, and a woman came darting in at the last moment, punched the inside plate to code Green 2. Doors shut. He looked furtively at her as the car began to move, averted his eyes quickly. The car made a one-section traverse and started down. She got off at 2. He stayed on, while the car picked up passengers, none that knew him. It stopped at 6, at 7, acquired more. At 8, 2 got out. 9. He exited with 4 others, walked toward the docks, his fingers sweating on the card. He passed occasional troopers who kept a general watch on the flow of traffic in the halls. None of them was likely to notice an ordinary man walking down a hall, stopping at a door, using a card to enter. It was the most natural of actions. Crossway 4 was coming up. There was no guard there. He slowed, thinking desperately, his heart speeding. He began to think of walking on. A walker just behind him hooked his sleeve and brusquely swept him forward. "Come on," the man said, and turned the corner with him. He made no resistance, fearing knives, instincts bred in queue. Of course the deliverer of the card had come down too, or had some confederate. He moved puppet-like, walked the cross-hall to the door. Let free the walker passing on, he used the card. He walked in. It was a small apartment with an unmade bed, discarded clothes lying all over it. A man walked out of a nook which served as kitchen, a nondescript man in his middle 30s. "Who are you?" the man asked him. It set him off balance. He started to pocket the card, but the man held out his hand, demanding it. He surrendered it. "Name?" the man asked. "Cressett." And desperately, "I'm due. They'll miss me any minute." "Then I won't keep you too long. You're from Russell Star, Mr. Cressett, yet?" "I thought you didn't know me." "A wife, Jen Justin. A son, Rami." He felt behind him for a littered chair, leaned on it, his heart paining him. "What are you talking about? Am I correct, Vasily Kresich?" He nodded. "The trust your fellow citizens of Q have placed in you to represent their interests. You are, of course, one whose initiative they respect regarding their interests." "Make your point." "Your constituency is in a bad position, papers entangled, and when the military security gets tighter, as it will, with Mazian's forces in control, I do wonder, Mr. Kresich, what kind of measures could be set up. You've all opposed union after one fashion and the other, of course, some out of genuine dislike, some out of self-interest, some out of convenience. You know, what sort were you?" "Where do you get your information?" "Official sources. I know a great deal about you that you never told this comp. I've done research. To put it finally, I've seen your wife and son, Mr. Cressage. Are you interested? He nodded, unable to do more than nod. He leaned on the chair, trying to breathe. They're well, on a station the name of which I know, where I saw them. Or perhaps moved by now, Union has realized their possible value, knowing the name of the man who represents so formidable a number of people on Pell. Computer search turned them up, but they'll not be lost again. Would you like to see them again, Mr. Cressage? What do you want from me? A little of your time, a little preparation for the future. You can protect yourself, your family, your constituents, who are pariahs under Mazian. What help could you get from Mazian in locating your family, or how could he get you to them? And surely there are other families divided who may now repent a rash decision, a decision Mazian forced them to take, who may understand that the real interest of any beyonder is the beyond itself. Your union, Cressage said, to have it beyond doubt. Mr. Cressage, I'm beyonder, aren't you? He sat down on the arm of the chair, for his knees were unsteady. What is it you want? Surely there's a power structure in Q, something you would know. Surely a man like you is in contact with it. I have contacts. And influence? And influence. You'll be in Union hands sooner or later, you realize that, if Mazian doesn't take measures of his own. Do you realize what he might do if he decides he wants to stay here? You think he's going to have Q near his ships? No, Mr. Cressage. You're, on the one hand, cheap labor, on the other, a nuisance, depending on the situation. The way things are going to go very soon, you're going to be a liability to him. What means can I use to contact you, Mr. Cressage? You contacted me today. Where is your office? Orange 91001. Is there comm? Station. Just station can call through to me, and it breaks down. Anytime I want to call, I have to clear it through comm central. It's set up that way. You can't call through, and it's always broken. Q is prone to riot, is it not? He nodded. Could the counselor of Q arrange one? A second time he nodded. Sweat was running down his face, his sides. Can you get me off, Pell? When you've done what you can for me, a guaranteed ticket off, Mr. Cressage. Gather your forces. I don't even ask to know who they are. But you'll know me. A message from me will use the word Vasily. That's all. Just that word. And if such a call should come, you see that there is immediate and widespread disturbance. And for that, you may begin to look forward to that reunion. Who are you? Go on now. You've lost no more than 10 minutes of your time. You can make up most of it. I'd hurry, Mr. Cressage. He rose, glanced back, left in haste, the corridor air cold on his face. No one challenged him. No one noticed. He matched the pace of the main corridor and decided that if challenged about the time, he had talked to Constantine, talked to people in the foyer, that he had gotten ill and stopped in a restroom. Constantine himself would attest that he had left upset. He wiped his face with his hand, his vision tending to blur, rounded the corner onto Green Dock, and kept walking into blue and toward the line. There was a knock at the door. Hale answered it, and John turned tensely from his place by the kitchen bar, let go a profound sigh of relief as Jess had walked in, and the door closed behind him. No trouble, Jessad said. They're covering up the signs, you know, preparing for in-station action. Makes finding directions a little difficult. Cressage, confound you. No trouble, Jessad stripped off his coat and tossed it to Hale's man, Kiefer, who had appeared from the bedroom. Kiefer felt the jacket pocket at once, recovered his papers with understandable relief. You didn't get stopped, Kiefer said. No, Jessad said. Just walked right to your apartment, went in, sent your partner out with the card, all very smooth. He agreed? John asked. Of course he agreed. Jessad was in an unusual mood, feeling a residue of excitement, his normally dull eyes alive with humor. He walked over to the bar and poured himself a drink. My clothes, Kiefer objected. Jessad laughed, sipped at the drink, then set it down and began to take off the shirt. He's back in Cuba now, and we control it. Part 2. Union Carrier Unity, amid the Union Fleet, Deep Space. Ayres sat down at the table in the main room, ignored the guards, to lean his head against his hands and try to recover his balance. He remained as he was for several breaths, then rose, walked to the water dispenser on the wall, unsteady on his feet. He moistened his fingers and bathed his face with the cold water, took a paper cup and drank to settle his stomach. Someone joined him in the room. He looked, scowled instantly, for it was Day and Jacoby, who sat down at the only table. He would not have gone back to it, but his legs were too weak to bear long standing. He did not bear up well through jump. Jacoby fared better, and that, too, he held against him. "It's close," Jacoby said. "I have a good idea where we are." Ayres sat down, forced his eyes into focus. The drugs made everything distant. "You should be proud of yourself." "Mazian will be there." "They don't confide in me, but it makes sense that he would. Is this being recorded?" "I have no idea. What if it is? The fact is, Mr. Ayres, that you can't retain Pell for the company. You can't protect it. You had your chance, and it's gone. And Pell doesn't want Mazian. Better union order than Mazian. Tell that to my companions." "Pell," Jacoby said, leaning forward, "deserves better than the company can give it. Better than Mazian will give it, that's sure. I'm for our interest, Mr. Ayres, and we deal as we must." "You could have dealt with us." "We did. For centuries." Ayres bit his lip, refusing to be drawn further into this argument. The drugs he had to have for jump fogged his thinking. He had already talked, and he had resolved not to. They wanted something of him, or they would not have brought him out of confinement and let him up onto this level of a ship. He leaned his head against his hand and tried to reason himself out of his muzziness while there was still time. "We're ready to go in," Jacoby pursued him. "You know that." Jacoby was trying to frighten him. He had been prostrate with terror during the last maneuvering. He had endured jump twice now, with the feeling that his guts were twisted inside out. He refused to think of another one. "I think they're going to have a talk with you," Jacoby said, "about a message for Pell. Something to the effect that Earth has signed a treaty, that Earth supports the right of the citizens of Pell to choose their own government, that kind of thing." He stared at Jacoby, doubting, for the first time, where right and wrong lay. Jacoby was from Pell. Whatever Earth's interests, those interests could not be served by antagonizing a man who might, despite all wishes to the contrary, end up high in the government on Pell. "You'll be interested, perhaps," Jacoby said, "in agreements involving Pell itself. If Earth doesn't want to be cut off, and you protest it seeks trade, it has to go through Pell, Mr. Ayres. We're important to you." "I'm well aware of that fact. Talk to me when you are in authority over Pell. Right now the authority on Pell is Angelo Constantine, and I have yet to see anything that says differently." "Deal now," Jacoby said, "and expect agreement. The party I represent can assure you of safeguards for your interests. We're a jumping-off point, Mr. Ayres, for Earth and home. A quiet takeover on Pell, a quiet stay for you while you're waiting on your companions to overtake you, for a journey home in a ship easily engaged here at Pell, or difficulties, prolonged difficulties, resulting from a long and difficult siege, damage, possibly the destruction of the station. I don't want that. I don't think you do. You're a humane man, Mr. Ayres, and I'm begging you, make it easy on Pell. Just tell the truth. Make it clear to them that there's a treaty, that their choice has to be union, that Earth has let them go. You work for union, thoroughly." "I want my station to survive, Mr. Ayres. Thousands upon thousands of people could die. You know what it is with Maisie and using it for cover? He can't hold it forever, but he can ruin it." Ayres sat staring at his hand, knowing that he could not reason accurately in his present condition, knowing that most of what he had been told in all his stay among them was a lie. "Perhaps we should work together, Mr. Jacoby, if it can assure an end to this without further bloodshed." Jacoby blinked, perhaps surprised. "Probably," Ayres said, "we are both realists, Mr. Jacoby. I suspect you of it. Self-determination is a nice term for last available choice, is it not? I comprehend your argument. Pell has no defenses. Station neutrality, meaning that you go with the winning side." "You have it, Mr. Ayres." "So do I," he said. Order in the beyond benefits trade, and that's to the company's interest. It was inevitable that independence would come out here. It's just come sooner than Earth was ready to understand. It would have been acknowledged long ago if not for the blindness of ideologies. Brighter days, Mr. Jacoby, are possible. May we live to see them. It was a lie, as sober-faced as he had ever delivered. He leaned back in his chair with nausea urging at him from the effects of jump and from outright terror. Mr. Ayers. He looked back at the doorway. It was Azov. The Union officer walked in, resplendent in black and silver. We are monitored, Ayers observed sourly. I don't delude myself with your affection, Mr. Ayers, only with your good sense. I'll make your recording. Azov shook his head. We go heralded, he said, but by a different warning. There's no hope that Mazian's ships will all be docked. We brought you along, first for the Maziani, and secondly because in the taking of Pell Station it will be useful to have a voice of former authority. He nodded weary assent. If it saves lives, sir. Azov simply stared at him, frowned finally. Take time to recover your equilibrium, sirs, and to contemplate what you might do to benefit Pell. Ayers looked to Jacoby as Azov left and saw that Jacoby was also capable of anxiety. Doubts? He asked Jacoby sourly. I have kin on that station, Jacoby said. Book 4, Chapter 1, Part 1. Pell, 10:10:52, 1100 hours. The station was calmer. Queries to legal affairs had begun, and that was a good indication that the tension on the station was easing. The input file was full of queries about military actions, threatened lawsuits, indignant protests from merchants on station who felt damages were due them for the continued curfew on the docks. There were protests from the merchanter ship Finity's End regarding a missing youth, the object of much anxiety in a theory that one of the military crews could have swept him up in impressment. In fact, the youth was probably in some station sleepover with a current infatuation from some other ship. Comp was quietly carrying out a card use search, not an easy matter, for merchanter passes were not in such frequent use as stationer cards. Damon entertained hopes of finding him safe, refused to take alarm until the record search had come in. He had seen too many of these come across his desk only to discover a young merchanter who had had a falling out with his family or drunk too much to listen to vid. The whole thing was more security's problem at this level, but security had its hands full, its men and women standing guard duty with haggard eyes and short tempers. L.A. could at least punch comp buttons and take up some of the clerical work. Another killing in queue. It was depressing, and there was absolutely nothing they could do but note the fact. There was a report of a guard under suspension, accused of smuggling a case of Downer wine into queue. Some officer had decided the problem should not wait, when it was likely there was petty smuggling going on everywhere among the merchanters out there. The man was being made an example. He had 3 postponed hearings in the afternoon. They were likely to be postponed again, because the council was meeting and the Board of Justices was involved in that. He decided to agree with the defender to that effect and put the message through, reserving the afternoon instead for the disposal of more queries that the lower levels of the office could not handle. And having disposed of that, he swung his chair about and looked back at Josh, who sat dutifully reading a book on the auxiliary unit and trying not to look bored as he ought to be. Hey, Damon said. Josh looked at him. Lunch? We can take a long one and work out at the gym. We can go there? It's open. Josh turned the machine off. Damon rose, leaving everything on hold, walked over and gathered up his jacket. Felt after cards and papers to be absolutely sure. Mazian's troops still stood guard here and there, as unreasonable as they ever had been. Josh likewise put on a jacket. They were about the same size, and it was borrowed. Lending, Josh would accept, if not giving, augmenting his small wardrobe so that he could come and go in the offices without undue attention. Damon held the door button, instructed the office outside to delay calls for 2 hours. Back at one, the secretary acknowledged, and turned to take an incoming call. Damon motioned Josh on through into the outer corridor. A half an hour at the gym, Damon said. then a sandwich at the concourse. I'm hungry.
Fine, Josh said. He looked nervously about him. Damon looked, too, and felt uneasy. The corridors had very little traffic, even yet. People were just not trusting of the situation. Some troops stood, distantly visible. The troops should all be pulled back, he said to Josh, by the end of this week. Our own security is taking over entirely in white. Green, maybe, in 2 days. Have patience. We're working on it.
They'll still do what they want, Josh said somberly.
Huh. Did Mallory, after all?
A shadow came on Josh's face.
I don't know. When I think about it, I still don't know.
Believe me.
They had reached the lift alone. A trooper stood at the corner of another corridor, a fact in the tail of the eye, nothing remarkable. He pushed the code for the core.
Had a bit of good news come in this morning. My brother called up, said things are smoothing out down there.
I'm glad, Josh murmured. The trooper moved suddenly, came toward them. Damon looked.
Others further down the hall started moving, all of them at a near run.
Abort that, the first trooper snapped, reaching them. She reached for the panel herself. We're on a call.
I can get you a priority, Damon said, to be rid of them. The move indicated trouble. He thought of them shoving stationers around on other levels.
Do it.
He took his card from his pocket, thrust it into the slot, and coded his priority. The lights went red. The rest of the troopers arrived as the car did, and armored shoulders pushed them aside as the troops all crowded in, leaving them there. The car whisked away, nonstop, for whatever destination they had coded from inside. There was not a trooper left in the corridor.
Damon looked at Josh, whose face was pale and set.
We take the next car, Damon said with a shrug. He was himself disturbed and quietly coded in Blue 9.
Eileen? Josh asked.
Want to get down there, he said. You come with me. If there's trouble, it's likely to end up on the dockside. I want to get down there.
The car delayed in coming. He waited several moments and finally used his card a second time, a second priority. The lights went red, signifying a car on priority call, then blinked, signifying nothing available. He slammed his fist against the wall, cast a second look at Josh. It was far to walk, easier to wait for a car to free itself, quicker in the long run. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.